Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar, broadcasting from my home studio. U.S. intelligence agencies say that Russia, China, and Iran are trying to interfere with the 2020 presidential election. A recent poll found that 59% of Americans believe and are worried foreign governments are trying to interfere. One of the strategies used to interfere is to promote information that isn't true about the candidates or news in the U.S. The Alliance for Securing Democracy is a bipartisan transatlantic national security advocacy group formed in July 2017 with the stated aim of countering efforts by Russia to undermine democratic institutions in the United States and Europe. 2 weeks ahead of the November 3rd election in the U.S., election security and disinformation about the election, the candidates, and news in the U.S. is a major concern. Joining us is Jessica Brandt, head of policy and research for the Alliance for Securing Democracy and a fellow at the German Marshall Fund of the United States. Ms. Brandt, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number is 1-800-729-7532. All right, before we get into the bigger picture issues, I want to talk about the story that was in the New York Post last week. It claims that Hunter Biden, the son of presidential candidate Joe Biden, helped arrange a meeting between Joe Biden and an executive at Ukrainian energy company Burisma in April 2015. Now, the context is Biden, while VP, sought to have a prosecutor investigating Burisma fired. The Biden campaign said there's no truth to this story. The sources of the story have been questioned for their reliability. The president's personal attorney, Rudy Giuliani, has a hard drive computer that Hunter Biden supposedly dropped off for repair. Some have said that this has the makings of Russian disinformation. What do you think?
Well, listen, there's a lot that's still not known, but one thing that I'm really encouraged by was the response to this story, which, you know, there's many elements of doubt about. And one thing that I, you know, in 2016, we saw the media, which I think is also an important institution of our democracy, report on hacked and leaked information in a way that was devoid of context. It didn't necessarily let voters know why certain information had been released, you know, for a weaponized purpose. Now, we don't, the full picture isn't yet known about the events of last week, but we saw, I think, a real effort to learn the lessons of 2016 and to report on that information with context, to be thoughtful about sharing it until that information can be verified by trusted sources. In order to, you know, diminish, I think, the spread of that information. Now, one thing I think is particularly interesting is you saw action by social media companies to, again, limit the spread of that information on their platforms until that information could be verified. And those steps took quite a bit of pushback. And I think this is emblematic of a dynamic where, you know, foreign actors can either weaponize the openness of our information system and, you know, potentially put information or seed information into our information environment that furthers their aims of chaos and doubt and making us, you know, doubt our own institutions of democracy. You know, or we can, you know, social media platforms, for example, took those steps to restrict the flow of that information and then faced enormous blowback. And what we saw, you know, my organization tracks, for example, Russian state media, you know, and diplomats on Twitter. And we saw, you know, real efforts to amplify claims of censorship. And, you know, so they capitalized on our response in order to, again, further the narrative that democracy isn't all it's cut out to be. It's a real catch-22.
We're going to talk about their strategies in just a moment. But just one final question about that story. Do you think that it has the makings? Are there some characteristics that you see there that would raise some red flags about it being foreign interference?
Yes, and you know, there's been additional reporting that you know, that our government has been exploring these questions. So I think we should, you know, wait for the full information to come out. But yes, it raises concerns for me.
Mm-hmm. All right. So look, before we get into those strategies that are being used, tell me about your organization, the Alliance for Securing Democracy. What is your mission?
Yeah. So we're a bipartisan organization based here in the United States and with offices in Europe as well. So bipartisan and transatlantic, and we're focused on combating foreign interference in democratic states and institutions. As you noted at the outset, our mission was initially to look at Russia and its attempts to undermine our democracy, but we have also expanded to look at China and Iran. We think about disinformation, but we also think about cyber operations and other tools that authoritarians use to diminish democracy's appeal, to sow chaos and doubt. And I think importantly, there's a lot of focus on elections, and that makes a lot of sense right now, especially an election is already underway. Especially this year, voting day is actually the last day to vote. It's not the only day to vote. But these operations they're ongoing. They started long before 2016, and they didn't stop. And I think it's important to consider elections as a flashpoint. But when we only look at elections, I think we miss we risk obscuring the bigger picture.
Well, let's talk about the three nations that we talked about that the intelligence agencies have pointed to as trying to interfere: Russia, China, and Iran. Let's talk about each of their motives. What's Russia's motive here?
Sure. So Russia is, by many measures, a declining power that seeks to compensate for its disadvantages by gaining relative advantage. It seeks an America that is polarized and divided because that's an America that's harder to govern itself. And that's an America that is distracted from playing a broader role in the world that might be adverse to Russia's interests. Russia also seeks to dense democracy's appeal, particularly to would-be activists at home. And so it wants both to actually make, sow chaos in the United States and make us doubt ourselves. And I would also say Russia is not particularly sensitive or has not been to attribution, given that it sees itself as gaining in stature when it sort of dominates the news. I think that's a very different dynamic when we talk about, for example, China.
The Mueller report and other intelligence agencies said in 2016 Russia was trying to spread disinformation and interfere in support of President Trump. Is that still the case?
That is what since at least, I think, February of 2020, that's what our intelligence community has said. But I think a focus on the horse race obscures the bigger picture that, an interest in a particular candidate is instrumental. The larger goal is chaos.
Okay, so what about China? China doesn't get near as much attention as Russian interference. Are they trying to interfere as much as Russia is? And what is China's goals?
Yeah, so I think China seeks more to shape the policy environment. That's what our intelligence community has told us. China's a rising power with a lot to lose. I think that is considerably more sensitive to attribution. It is less bold in this space. For example, while I see over the past year in particular, China has gotten more assertive, particularly with its information operations, those are focused on things like the COVID crisis and shaping, geopolitical narratives around COVID, using it as an example to highlight the weaknesses and failings of our response in order to, lift up their way of doing business as a model. So, China seeks to make the world, safe for China's interests, but I see it as, much more focused on shaping the broader policy environment, which is, again, why I think a hyper-focus on elections risks the bigger picture.
Well, but with that said, the intelligence agencies say that China favors a Joe Biden presidency over a continued Trump presidency.
I think a focus on the particularities of the horse race sort of misses the bigger picture. And I also think, that Russia is the real, when we think about our election, Russia is the real, is the bigger, sort of thing we need to be focused on. That Russia's intentions and capabilities, Russia has, we've been told, very active campaign to undermine our election. And we can talk a little bit about what the elements of that campaign have been. So I think that's the place to focus.
What about Iran? What's Iran trying to do?
So Iran, uses some of the disinformation tactics that we see from Russia. But again, I think its ambitions are a little smaller. And it's mostly focused on, geopolitical topics of relevance and interest to them. But we have seen, social media platforms take down campaigns of Iranian origin as well.
So how are these nations trying to interfere in the election, spread this disinformation, affect policy? What are some of their strategies?
Yeah. So as I said, it's been, I think, at least since February 2020 that our intelligence community has assessed a very active effort on the part of Russia to interfere. We know that, Treasury has designated several individuals, including for interference activities, including Andrei Derkach, a pro-Kremlin Ukrainian parliamentarian. And these government warnings are supported by what we've seen from researchers, including our own team, and then platform social media companies that have taken action on their platforms. The platforms have removed multiple operations. One that's maybe emblematic of recent trends was an operation that included efforts to recruit Americans and real journalists to write for online journals that were, set up by Russia. Peace Data was the name of one of these journals, and it was designed to reach left-leaning Americans, which I think also underscores the point that these operations, target both sides of the aisle. But here we see sort of, I think, an evolution or a maturation of Russia's strategies and tactics, where it's, seeking to recruit, real, live, unwitting Americans, to participate in these operations. It's something we've seen them, test out in other places, in Africa in particular. You can understand why, right? Since 2016, the platforms have gotten much better at seeing and taking down these kinds of, coordinated and authentic behavior, we say is a term of art. They've, raised the bar. And, targeting or using, co-opting authentic domestic voices and institutions makes it much harder, for platforms and governments to respond to these kinds of challenges, both because for obvious reasons as well, they should, it triggers, immediately triggers like constitutional protections around speech, which it should. It also changes the political dynamics for platforms. So there's a real, I think, evolving effort to engage authentic domestic voices and institutions.
We're going to talk about some other changes from 2016 in just a moment. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. I want to remind you that we will continue on Smart Talk to have conversations with the candidates on the November 3rd ballot. Ends this week. We have our last one coming up Friday, but throughout the week we'll be talking with candidates that voters can hear where they stand on the issues and hope that helps you make a decision on who you're going to vote for. That's coming up all this week on WITF Smart Talk. Our guest during this portion of today's program is Jessica Brandt, head of policy and research for the Alliance for Security and Democracy and a fellow at the German Marshall Fund of the United States. We're talking about foreign interference in the elections, in policy, disinformation, a lot of issues surrounding how Americans are at least trying to be manipulated by some of these foreign governments. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we're at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Ms. Brandt, I just said manipulated by foreign governments. Is it the government of these countries that the governments of these countries that are attempting to do this?
So Russia often works through proxies, but generally speaking, yes. Mm-hmm. And one of the, you know, you asked earlier a little bit about our organization. We used to track, Russian trolls on Twitter, and we stopped doing that. In part because it got, not particularly interesting. Like, give me a contentious topic in the news, and I can guarantee you that there are trolls amplifying the most divisive content on the right and the left, right? It's both sides of the political spectrum. And so what we've shifted to doing is tracking the state media apparatus and on Twitter and their broadcasts, as well as diplomats on Twitter. And we do this because it allows us to see the narratives that we can, definitively attribute to the Russian and Chinese and now Iranian governments, in order to see, what narratives the governments themselves are interested in promoting, and and where those narratives, how those narratives spread.
You said earlier, just before our break, that you talked about something that has changed since 2016. You said the maturation process of Russian interference. Are there other changes that are, something that is different from 2016 as to 2020?
Yeah, there are many, many changes. So I would say overall, we're, witnessing a shift towards narrower, more tailored operations that are harder to uncover, but cover broad swaths of the information ecosystem. It's a lot less focused on troll farm content and produced by the IRA, the Internet Research Agency, that infamous troll farm. And this is in part because the Russian tactics are evolving, but our defense mechanisms are evolving, so they're sort of evolving together. So it's partly about evading the measures that we've put in place to forestall some of the actions that we saw in 2016. But it's also because as my colleague says, the fire is already raging, right? Russia does not need large quantities of troll farm content to amplify very divisive political narratives in the United States, or to sow chaos, or to undermine, trust institutions. We are already doing that. And so, as this colleague says in her metaphor, Russia does is just, throws a little bit of accelerant on the fire to direct it, one way or another. But it doesn't, Russia generally does not create narratives out of whole cloth, but amplify these. Divisive narratives that already exist in our society. So that's generally speaking. I mean, in terms of tactics, I think, we see there's something called perception hacking, right? It's exploiting the anticipation of manipulation to claim that manipulation has happened, whether or not manipulation has actually happened. And this is based on, the idea that you don't actually have to change a single vote to create the impression that you did. And the impression alone is what's damaging. And so, I think in 2016, we were caught flat-footed by this. In 2020, that's not the case. And so, there's a lot of room here, especially because of the tenor of our domestic debates, for, Russia to claim, the existence of widespread manipulation and to try to create the impression of widespread manipulation, regardless of whether that manipulation has happened. And this is something that the FBI and CISA and their, they've issued several warnings, and this is something that they've warned about.
Let's take a phone call from Egan in Lancaster. Egan, you're on the air.
Good morning. Good
morning.
Thank you for having my call. Hello.
Yes, welcome.
Thank you. The United States, the United States has been very busy in manipulating other governments, either by CIA operations, military operations, and the your guest is not speaking about the American threat to other countries and other governments, just talking about the threat of other countries on us. So can you expand your criticism of the threat to democracy? Thank you.
Egan, thanks for your call. Jessica Brandt, is he talking about something that's equal?
So, you know, I think, for example, U.S. support for democracy promotion or democracy abroad, U.S. democracy support abroad, generally is, you know, focused on establishing processes and institutions elsewhere. It's transparent, and it's about, you know, like, so when, you know, NDI or IRI go out and create, help to create capacity in other societies, it's about facilitating a process, and it's not about, you know, putting the thumb on the scale for a particular candidate. And again, it's transparent. So the activities that we're talking about are non-transparent, and generally not, you know, about increasing the effectiveness of deliberative processes, but about again creating chaos. It's destructive. Those are some key differences that I see.
But the United States is involved in cyber attacks on other countries, correct?
Sure, we have cyber capabilities that we, you know, that we use. I think it's very important to I guess, separate or acknowledge, like, legitimate nation-state influence, which I think I see as fundamentally different from the exercise of, like, legitimate influence. That's diplomacy. That's the use of, you know, use of various forms of economic leverage, and capabilities, including cyber. And I think what we're talking about is something a little bit different here.
I want to talk about some specifics, if we can. In 2016, or actually after 2016, after the investigations occurred, there were some specific examples of disinformation or interference that were cited. Are there some now that you could point to that maybe have become popular on social media or have been spread by word of mouth that have been determined that, you know, they started with Russian interference?
So I think, you know, the interesting thing or the thing to know about Russian interference, Russian disinformation operations, is they generally do not inject new narratives. It's about amplifying the most divisive claims and arguments already in our society, lifting them up, making them appear more salient. So, you know, I think maybe give you a couple of examples from the primary season, like the Iowa caucus debacle, for example. We saw you know, plenty of, I think your listeners may remember there was an app that malfunctioned causing reporting delays. Bear that in mind when we think about what might happen on November 3rd.
Sure, yeah.
And that was used, you know, and there were, we saw, you know, sort of theories bubble up online, you know, conspiracy theories about, you know, connections, purported murky ties between various candidates in the app, and or, you know, claims that the, you know, it was a deliberate attempt by the, you know, Russian, the you know, sort of quote mainstream media and the you know, Democratic Party to, for example, deny, you know, Senator Sanders a clear win on election night. And these were, you know, these were arguments that were made by real Americans and, you know, views that were honestly come by, but that were, you know, really, like, leaned into. These are the kinds of arguments that, you know, the Russian government and its proxies hope to lift up. And again, it's really not about, you know, individual candidates or the fortunes of individual candidates. It's about, you know, using that as a vector, you know, a vector for chaos, right, to split to amplify divisions within the Democratic Party, to depress trust in the institutional parties, to depress trust in the media. That's the real goal.
What about the Black Lives Matter movement and the protests that have occurred around the country since the killing of George Floyd back in May? Is there evidence that the Russians have tried to use that issue as the device to divide the country even more?
Yeah. I mean, this is, going back to 2016, pressing on, precisely this sort of division is exactly what Russia hopes to do. It's also fodder for a very classic Russian technique, which is whataboutism, right? You guys criticize us, but, democracy all it's cracked up to be. When we as a society, I think, fail to kind of live up to our promise, right? And when they can point to systemic racism and inequality, it really provides the kind of fodder, that Russia loves for this kind of whataboutism.
Yeah, that's something that Russia and even before, the Soviet Union would often try to use, divide the United States, the American people, along racial lines and sow some divisiveness amongst when it comes to racial issues, right?
Yes, and to denigrate democracy and paint it as hypocritical, not all it's cracked up to be. Right. And part of that is about regime security, being able to, talk to a domestic audience, a Russian domestic audience and say, do you really want that? Like, it's a mess. And then part of it is about sort of denting democracy's appeal globally. We've seen a little bit of it actually from China over the summer, in a more limited way. But we saw some of that.
Like what? Like what from China?
We had we saw, for example, Beijing spokesperson, tweet with the hashtag I can't breathe, kind of trolling the United States on race and calling out this hypocrisy.
I want to turn to election security for a moment. You touched on it, referred to it just a few minutes ago, but when talking about the Iowa caucuses and what can be anticipated come November and hopefully not beyond November with getting the results of this election. What about election security in the United States? Are there places around the country where there are concerns?
So let's talk about Pennsylvania maybe for a minute. I think it's probably of most interest to your listeners, which is, Pennsylvania is a place where there's a lot of uncertainty right now. There are questions about whether ballots are going to be accepted after Election Day and about, I suppose, drop boxes that are kind of tied up in the courts. And as I'm sure many of your listeners know, the state legislature still hasn't decided about whether election officials can touch the ballots before Election Day. As of right now, they can't, which could lead to long delays in tallying results. And what we know is that disinformation thrives on uncertainty, that, people seek information and bad actors are going to be there to fill the void. And so, there's real concern that foreign adversaries will, use these potential delays to discredit electoral processes to their advantage. And the FBI and CISA have also, issued a warning, to this, specifically on this issue, that the time that will may be required to certify and announce results will be a window in which, we can expect that foreign actors will disseminate disinformation, and we can expect that disinformation to look like, reports of voter suppression, reports of cyber attacks on election infrastructure. Again, remember, whether or not there actually were those attacks, or whether or not those attacks were actually successful. I'm sure that they will amplify claims about, voter fraud or ballot fraud, again, with the ultimate and underlying goal of making Americans, you know, doubt themselves and doubt the legitimacy of the election.
Well, here's one of the key questions I'm sure a lot of our listeners have. What can they do? What can Americans do to ensure the information they're getting is legitimate and not a disinformation, part of a disinformation campaign by a foreign government?
Yeah. So, you know, tactically, like, the most important thing you can do is seek information, particularly about voting, from trusted sources. So state and local election officials, your local officials' websites, those are great places to go. One of the projects our organization is interested in is thinking about, you know, a number of making sure that the social media accounts, for example, of county and state board of elections get verified in time for election day, so that you know that what you're looking at, you know, has that blue check, for example, if you're looking up information about voting on your, you know, on social media platforms. But I would say, again, your local election officials are the right place to turn for true and accurate information about voting.
I want to thank our guest for being with us today. Joining us today was Jessica Brandt, head of policy and research for the Alliance for Security and Democracy. She's a fellow at the German Marshall Fund of the United States. Jessica Brandt, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks so much for having me. I enjoyed it.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. WITF's election 2020 coverage on Smart Talk continues today with a candidate running for statewide office. The Democratic candidate for Pennsylvania Auditor General, Nina Amon, joins us to discuss issues before the election. The Pennsylvania Department of Auditor General is the chief fiscal watchdog of the Commonwealth. It is responsible for using audits to ensure that all state money is spent legally and properly. Other candidates on the ballot are Republican Tim DeFore, Green Party candidate Olivia Fasson, and Jennifer Moore, representing the Libertarian Party. Mr. DeFore appeared on the program October 5th. You can hear that conversation at WITF.org. The other candidates have not responded to our invitations to appear. Nina Amon, want to thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Outside Philadelphia, many may be meeting Nina Amon for the first time. Tell us about yourself.
So, first of all, I'm delighted to be the Democratic nominee for this position of Auditor General. We had a very hotly contested primary that actually helped me get introduced to a lot of our voters. And now I have to get more broadly introduced to the entire state of Pennsylvania, not just the Democrats. I am a scientist by training. I have my PhD from the University of Pennsylvania in chemistry, and then did a molecular genetics postdoc, worked in the field, and moved on to public service, served as a deputy mayor for public engagement, setting up that department for the first time in the city of Philadelphia, having to, as a cabinet member, look at efficiencies in a $4 billion budget, served President Obama on his commission for Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders, giving me an up-close look at federal government and public policy and inclusion issues. And have been an advocate for women. I'm currently on the board of the National Organization for Women. I used to be a local chapter president in Philadelphia, and I've served in different civic capacities, which includes the Philadelphia Foundation, where I was a grant-making chair. We put out for $40 million annually into the local nonprofits, as well as served on the investment committee, where we had to safeguard the over $500 million endowment. So all of this gives me a very broad experience that I bring to the table.
Why did you decide to run for Auditor General?
So I am an immigrant to this country, I lived as a child through a war of independence, creating the country of Bangladesh. That told me how important freedom was to people, that people would be willing to sacrifice, make the ultimate sacrifice. In 9 months, 3 million people were killed, and 200,000 women and girls were brutalized. That has created a frame for me of thinking, making me clear, very keenly aware of what sacrifice it takes to get your voice heard. So that's my baseline of saying that I want to make sure everybody is seen and heard, and that's what I think government should do. This position particularly is, because it's an independent position answering only to the constituents of Pennsylvania, which means that my job will be, as you said at the top of the program, making sure your tax dollars are used with integrity. But it's also very important that they're used with accountability and transparency so people have faith in government. I am deeply of the belief that when you marry the goal of government, which I believe is to do public good, and you marry it to the hashtag I use, leave no one behind, you have a government that sees and serves everyone. And because I know when it doesn't, this is one of the reasons why I'm so interested in serving in this capacity.
You know, from what I understand, you have had a brilliant career and an inspiring life story, but how does being a molecular biologist and working for as deputy mayor for public engagement under Mayor Kenney in Philadelphia translate to being an effective auditor general?
So this is where the auditor general is a leadership job at the core. We have a professional staff of CPAs, of auditors, of investigators who've been there many years, who know the actual nitty-gritty of carrying out the job of going into the field, doing the audit, making sure our audits are planned and designed with all the right controls. What I bring to the table, because of this broad experience, or because of the leadership experience that I've had, is how do we shape the direction of this office? This is an executive office along with the governor, the attorney general, and the state treasurer. We are part of the strategic vision for Pennsylvania. This particular office can have a huge impact using all the data we collect with every audit to actually inform how our budget should be shaped. So if we are not doing in-depth audits which give us information as to how Pennsylvanians are being served with their tax dollars, then we're doing a disservice. Why I think someone like me who has the ability to analyze, organize, and make sure we can get our recommendations to actually stick, that's the political part of the job. All of these skill sets are really important. You know, when we look at the actual work, the actual CPA test, that has not been changed in the last 50 years. And we need to have some more lens in the audits that we do. So we are really looking at equity as part of the what we're assessing in how our dollars are spent. And these are the kinds of things that I have deep experience in and working with our CPAs and our investigators and all the staff, the 350-plus staff who are in that office. That's going to be part of the leadership inside the department and the leadership outside, working with the political atmosphere, working with the public. That's the other piece that is really, really important, is making sure this office has accessibility. So each county knows what is happening and what is our role in making sure that tax dollars are used better.
Something you just said a moment ago, that we should be really looking into equity. If you would expand on that, what do you mean that the Auditor General should be looking into equity?
So, for example, let's take an example. You know, we do audits of all tax dollars, including federal dollars that flow through us. We have an issue and a problem. The only auditor general who ever talks about this, a candidate who's ever talked, or actually an auditor general, we have an issue in the country of maternal mortality. Women are dying at childbirth more than they used to 25 years ago. And black women are dying three times more than white women. When we look at how our federal dollars are used in the healthcare system, we would have that lens to actually look at how our hospitals, what is the record, what is the outcome, how are we addressing this issue. That is a perfect example of how we can actually make a real difference in looking at the outcomes to shape how those dollars are used.
You know, you've been the Philadelphia Inquirer has endorsed your candidacy, but I have seen, and one of the things that the Inquirer said was that Pennsylvania certainly could use a woman of color in statewide office. You would be the first woman of color elected to statewide office if you were to win this election. But I've seen at least one other editorial that said that what you've been talking about, that you're more interested in policy and would be better suited running for the state legislature. What do you say to that?
So I push back on that because we should all be interested in better public policy. That's how we actually govern, right? So my relationship using the Auditor General's office and data to do a feedback loop with the Appropriations Committee, for example, when the budget priorities are set, when, you know, the budget is a moral document, each one of us in public service must be invested in making sure that government is serving everyone. So whether it's from the office of the executive side of the branch of government and governor or auditor general or state treasurer or attorney general, or on the legislature side, we all need to be worried about that because we know there's a lot of, the disparity in how services are delivered across 67 counties. Case in point, for example, in the rural counties, I've just been traveling across Pennsylvania, and the access to high-speed broadband, that is a huge issue in rural counties. That is something that the Office of the Auditor General can actually look at to see how the deals that we had made with Verizon and Comcast and how the service is actually happening. And the deals that were made with DOC. What's going on there? Why do some rural countries have such poor service? That's an issue of healthcare, issue of education, issue of economics. I mean, agriculture needs high-speed broadband. So if I am that, sort of that watchdog, making sure our tax dollars are used equitably, that's what I mean to say, what is the outcome of the dollars we've used? Because our data will tell us that. So I really think that there's no disconnect when one says that we need to be equitable in how our services are delivered.
You've mentioned a few already, but if you are elected, what would be your priorities? I mean, is there something that you would want to do on day one as Pennsylvania's Auditor General?
So, we are all operating in a COVID pandemic environment. That's really shaping everything we do in government right now, and our public service is impacted by that. The immediate things, because of the pandemic, are looking at how those dollars have flowed. You know, the federal dollars that came in for this relief was very fast, uniquely fast, because we needed to get it to the people. It was uniquely complex because it flowed from many different agencies, the Department of the Treasury, Federal Emergency Management, small businesses, health, education, labor. They, in turn, targeted a wide array of recipients, which was the state and local government, and went through various channels. So what our job is going to be to really assess, sort of going back to see what happened with that money. We had new programs, included the pandemic unemployment assistance. Then we had the Paycheck Protection Program. These were new programs, so they did not have the benefit of established application processes. They were operating under newly introduced untested integrity controls. We know there's room for fraud and abuse there. So that would be the first line of business I would take up to make sure we had some fraud risk assessments. We had done some targeted analytics to use new data sources to mitigate this for fraud, waste, and abuse. We would have a look to see a central project management office at the state level in order to address these issues and make it a much smoother and sustainable way of doing this. We would have to look at the collective intelligence on the data gathering and the sharing of information, how that happens. So these are some of the immediate things. My other issue is going to be that I want to design a pandemic preparedness audit because of what we've just been, just what I just described and what we have been experiencing. Our federal government has failed us. they were supposed to be the central command when we had an issue such as this crisis. And we've seen this in operation in prior administrations. And, you know, we had only two cases of Ebola. We had H1N1 that was quickly, taken care of. That the implications of not having that means that we in our state really have to be prepared, and I want to have a health, an education, and an economic component to that audit process. So we're looking at all the facets that would impact Pennsylvanians if we were to face another one, because, you know, and we have to understand that the globe is a much smaller place. We are interacting with each other, so it is important that we are ready. So that's the other first thing that I want to do. But my, you know, platform piece has been about making sure we have healthcare, in, and specifically looking at the price of prescription drugs. Education, why are we 47th in the country in how much we invest in our children? And I'm very interested in looking at what our workforce development looks like, where those dollars are going, and really making sure we are ready for the jobs of the new millennium. These are the main three things that I'm really interested in.
But I'm curious, when you say that education, why we're 47th in the country and investing in higher education, tell me, walk me through how the Auditor General would look into that.
So let's start even before higher education. Our school districts only get 38% of their budget from the state. And the left is left at the mercy of local municipalities and the property taxes they collect. We need to, you know, level that playing field. That's just unfair to children if they're born in a particular zip code where the property taxes don't yield enough, right? And also, the federal government has a very small portion in these budgets. I deeply believe that with the data I would give to our governor, our legislature, we need to advocate for the federal government to have a bigger portion in our education budget, because they have all these mandates they put out for the states to fulfill, and those are not funded properly. So we have, you know, an oversight there in terms of understanding where we are and where we need to be. The data that we have in this office can really help generate models that look at what it would look like given different ratios of where investment comes from in our children. So there's a lot to be done. And, you know, when you talk about higher education, I'm a proponent of making sure our community colleges are free, because when a community college student has to work to afford just community college right now, they have to work about 35 hours. And that's a lot of hours when you're trying to go to school and lead a life, might have a family. And if you're going to a four-year college, that's 70 hours a week. So these are the data people must know, our legislators must know. Why are we, you know, handicapping our children who are our future, literally, who are going to bring the state into, you know, competing on the global platform, global stage, so that we prosper, so all people prosper in Pennsylvania. I think these are critical issues.
We were almost out of time. In fact, we have about a minute left, and I like to allow our candidates to leave a message with voters. What would your message be?
My message would be, I'm running to be your Auditor General, to use the power of this office to create more transparency and efficiency in our state government, along with making sure your tax dollars are used with integrity, and to make sure people feel our government is working for them, not just the insiders and the elite. I will ensure that, you know, there's accountability and equity with the integrity of the use of the dollars. And we can see at this time of the pandemic crisis, Pennsylvanians deserve to know where every state dollar is being spent and whether it's being spent efficiently and effectively. I will make sure, you know, I will work on the issue of healthcare and access and affordability, spur job growth, and ensure a quality education in a safe environment for teachers and students. So I hope that people hear me and understand that I will be their people's auditor, the advocate for them, using our office with the data that we collect to do that. And as I said before, I deeply believe government is there to do public good. And using my hashtag of Leave No One Behind, I want to make sure we have a government that sees and serves everyone. And I hope I can earn the vote of your listeners.
Dr. Nina Ahmad, running for Pennsylvania Auditor General, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
WITF's election coverage is supported by the law firm of Saul Ewing, Arnstein & Lear.